Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The Brian Lehrer Show is not live today, so we won't be taking any calls. But we thought we'd take this opportunity to bring you some of our favorite recent segments. So enjoy, and remember that our comments page is always open. Go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show. Brian Lehrer on WNYC and WNYC.org. Thanks so much for listening today. Many of you probably saw the extensive interview that New York Times economics columnist David Leonhardt conducted with President Obama recently. And tucked about two-thirds of the way into the interview was an exchange between the two about end-of-life care, how treating those who are dying accounts for up to 80% of our health care costs, that keeping someone alive for an extra week can cost as much as $20,000. And the president got very personal as well, telling the story of how his grandmother was kept alive in the hospital for the final 2 weeks of her life after a hip surgery before she finally passed away in early November. Well, Obama seems to recognize that end-of-life health care isn't just a fiscal policy question, of course, but a moral and personal and emotional one. He told Leonhardt that we would need doctors, scientists, and ethicists to guide the country through, quote, a very difficult democratic conversation, unquote. He went on to say, quote, it is very difficult to imagine the country making those decisions just through the normal political channels, unquote. And yet he brought it up. So let's pick up that conversation now and follow it on those two tracks. On the one hand, the policy questions of how you cut end-of-life costs, and the other track, all those moral, ethical, very difficult questions that, of course, come up when it comes to keeping a human being alive. Judy Bachrach is the founder of the online advice column, thecheckoutline.org, which does mean what you think it does. She's a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and a frequent contributor and columnist to Obit magazine, an online magazine about life, death, and transitions. Judy, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks so much, Brian.
And along with Judy is David Leonhardt himself, the man with whom the president had this kind of remarkable exchange. David, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. It's nice to be here.
And David, did you plan on bringing this topic up during the interview, or did the president go there on his own?
He went to end-of-life care on his own. I had very much planned to go to health care because he has essentially accepted the economic diagnosis, if you will, that's shared by pretty much all economists who've looked at this, which is our deficit problem is really a health care problem. Everything else pales in comparison to the fiscal problem that healthcare creates, because we're just, not only are we getting older, but even more so, we are spending more and more and more on healthcare for any individual person. And so I wanted to talk about how we try to get away from a model in which we spend massive amounts of money on healthcare, in many cases on things that don't actually improve health. And he then brought up end-of-life care as his example of what he considers to be the most difficult, the thorniest issue within healthcare.
Is he right in saying that end-of-life costs account for up to 80% of our healthcare expenses?
That's a little bit higher than the numbers I've seen, but I think this is one of these things in which, depending on how you cut the numbers, you can get different numbers, right? I mean, you could argue that any care after age, I don't know, 30 is end-of-life care. So it obviously depends on where you put the window of end-of-life care.
Right. Well, he put it at the last 2 weeks. I've seen other stats that refer to the last 6 months of life, and that you know, gobbles up some astronomical percentage of total health care costs. But, of course, it raises an unbelievable ethical and moral question, which is, can we even talk about this and make policy decisions around this when individual human lives are at stake? Can we say that as a matter of national policy, we discourage or won't reimburse, if it's Medicare, things that are very expensive and that are only expected to keep people alive for a relatively short time? David, does the government have any policies like that already, as far as you know?
It doesn't do much of that. And I think the important thing to recognize is we have to have that discussion. This notion that, no, this is healthcare, we can't ration it, is just fundamentally wrong. It's a question of how we ration it. We ration everything in our society. We are not a society of unlimited resources. We ration homes, we ration cars, we ration food, and we do ration healthcare. And there are a lot of forms of healthcare right now that we are not doing. We are not doing very good disease management on things like diabetes. We are obviously not doing a very good job of treating the 50 million people who don't have health insurance. We are not doing a very good job of integrated care for people who have hard to diagnose conditions. And instead, what we're doing is spending huge amounts of money on some forms of care that don't actually improve health. And end-of-life care is very much in that basket. So we are already rationing health care, and we're not doing a very good job of it. And so the question is, how can we make some unbelievably difficult choices around some of these end-of-life things so that we do a better job of spending money on healthcare that makes people healthier?
And so, Judy Bachrach, help us imagine what this kind of national difficult conversation, as the president put it, might look like. Where do we start?
Well, the president mentioned that he wanted panels of ethicists and doctors and medical personnel to discuss it. But I think he left out a very important component. I think there has to be a national dialogue among people, and the people of the United States have to be told there is something worse than death, and that is a bad death. Bad deaths occur when people are kept alive without any hope of recovery. And when you get machines and you get chemotherapy and you get radiation and you get sick and weaker and you stretch out your life, meaning you continue to breathe, perhaps, but you don't continue to live. And I think that's the most important thing we have to tell people. It's not a pleasant conversation, but everybody is realizing it these days. I get letters on both the checkoutline.org and on obitmag.com all the time from people who are terminally ill, have no hope, and don't want the pain and don't want the agony. And they're right.
Listeners, do you want to participate in this little piece of this very difficult Democratic conversation? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer's show. Can we ever talk about money and policy when deciding on the care of an individual who could be kept alive? If it's money that could be otherwise spent to improve other people's quality of life or lengthen lives more significantly, is this a trade-off that you're willing to have the government make as a matter of policy? 212-433-WNYC, and all our lines are already full, or post to WNYC.org. Judy?
There's just one thing I want to say. There's a way for the administration to get this word across, to get the dialogue going, and that's to have advertising, you know, government-sponsored advertising. What do you think? Here's the possibilities open to you. What do you think? And the way you go about resolving it, I feel, is if somebody really is terminally ill and has, say, 3 months to live, and like Obama's grandmother, not only has cancer but breaks a hip and then becomes demented.
And the question in that case was, do you do the tens of thousands of dollar hip surgery when she's only got a few weeks to live?
Correct.
But, David, that's a very, very tough choice, because somebody who's just broken their hip is in a tremendous amount of pain, probably. I don't know if she had any mobility left at that time. But there's a tough choice. When it's your grandmother and it's not this abstract policy discussion, it's like, oh, my God, how could we not do this in many cases?
That's right. And I think choices like that are really hard. And he said, look, I would have paid for this out of my own pocket. Thanks to his books, he's actually now quite wealthy. And I said, right, but isn't it going to be hard for people who can't do that? And he said, absolutely. I think when you think about an example like that, that's where this is really the hardest. I think where there's some reason for hope from a policy perspective is when you look at the enormous variation that is already out there. It's not that every hospital is doing a bad job of this. So if you were to look at the University of California at San Francisco Medical Center, one of the finest medical centers in the world, on average, patients spend 11 days in the hospital during their last 6 months of life. At NYU, they spend 27 days on average in their last 6 months of life. That suggests pretty clearly that NYU is doing something wrong and UCSF is doing something right. And so one of the questions is, how can we have policy essentially force a place like NYU, which for the healthcare experts who look at this is notoriously bad at end-of-life care, notoriously invasive and expensive, become more like Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston or UCSF in California?
Hospices, that's the answer. Part of the answer.
I think that's right.
Part of the answer. Now, I want to read the full quote because it's so interesting, and it goes deeper into what you were just saying, David, from the president's interview with you. David Leonhardt from the New York Times talked about the economy with the president, and it got into this topic of end-of-life healthcare costs. And on his grandmother's hip replacement 2 weeks before she died, the president said, quote, "I don't know how much that hip replacement cost. I would have paid out of pocket for that hip replacement just because she's my grandmother. Whether, sort of in the aggregate, society making those decisions to give my grandmother or everybody else's aging grandparents or parents a hip replacement when they're terminally ill is a sustainable model is a very difficult question. If somebody told me that my grandmother couldn't have a hip replacement and she had to lie there in misery in the waning days of her life, that would be pretty upsetting."
But that's not the only option, Brian. That is not the only option. If you have a fractured hip and you have terminal cancer and X number of days to live, you can have painkillers.
Morphine.
Yes.
And I think what's important to remember is, in many ways, he was highlighting the most difficult aspect of this. We don't hear horror stories out of UCSF about all the people who want end-of-life care and are denied it, right? So it's not as if UCSF is providing worse care than NYU. In fact, by many measures, the places that do less invasive care, places like UCSF and Mayo Clinic, are actually providing higher quality end-of-life care than places like UCLA and NYU that spend so much more.
Chris in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with David Leonhardt from the New York Times and Judy Bachrach of thecheckoutline.org. Hi.
Hello. These discussions always seem to take as a matter of fact that our system is functional. I mean, it seems to me that no other industrialized country is grappling with these problems because they have their health care system under control. They don't to have this discussion. You're buying into the model that yes, these outrageous prices are legitimate, and so therefore we have to live by these.
You're saying
and then start denying people care because the prices are so high.
You're actually saying the cost of the hip surgery itself, for example,
for any consideration to me of what. Of denying care to people is predicated on the idea that this system is that these costs the cost of health care is legit.
Mm-hmm. David Leonhardt, do you want to react to Chris?
There are two separate issues. There are more than two, but among the issues are two separate issues in our healthcare costs. One is it's true, as he points out, everything we do costs more than it does in other countries. Doctors here are paid more. I do think, though, that's secondary to the volume of stuff that we do. The volume of medical care that we do in this country, the number of MRIs.
But what do they do in a country like Canada? Judy, do you have any idea where there is the single-payer system and supposedly anybody can get anything that their doctor prescribes? Is there a difference in values? Does the government ration this? Do you know?
All governments ration. It would be foolish to assume that any government doesn't ration. Obviously, we ration it, as David says. And Canada, by the way, which everybody admires because of the single-payer system, it depends on the city that you live in Canada, whether you live in rural Canada or you live in a big city like Toronto. The nature of your health care is contingent in Canada on where you live just as much as it is in the United States. And there are a lot of people who have grievances about the Canadian system. So before we say, gosh, they're all saints there, we have to take stock of what really happens. Can I just finish the sentence? Here's what I want to say. One of the problems in the United States is not the patient, it's the doctor. doctors here are averse to allowing people to die. That is not how they've been trained, and that's not what they want to do. And frankly, there's also, on occasion, a financial incentive to have your patient live and get money from Medicare or whoever, the insurance company. So we have to change not simply the government's notion of, you know, rationing health care and where we should ration it, but also the individual professionals as well as the United States population.
That's a powerful point, David, that there is a financial incentive for doctors, and not to cast any aspersions on the ethics of doctors in general, because this is such a widespread practice to try to keep people alive till the very possible last day. But if we are spending something like 80% of our health care costs on the last few weeks or months of life, then that's where doctors are making a whole lot of their income.
That's right. And we set up a system with really bad incentives, and doctors then react to those incentives rationally. And I don't think we should be surprised that they do. We don't give particularly good reimbursement for basic care or for end-of-life hospice care. And so we basically don't pay doctors enough to do the kinds of care we should want, and we pay them too much to do care in many cases that doesn't help. I just wanted to echo Judy's point about Canada. Canada's obviously the closest country to us, at least in New York, but it is really not the best model. I'm fairly convinced some of these European countries that also have a very different system from us have better functioning healthcare systems than Canada. So I think we're probably better off looking to France or Holland or Switzerland.
But if they all have more overt government dictated cost controls, then those countries must have already grappled with the end of life cost issue in a way that the United States is just beginning to, David, correct?
Yes. Absolutely.
They have indeed. Certain countries like the Netherlands go even further, as I'm sure you know. They allow people who feel that life has nothing left for them because they are terminally ill and in pain very often to have their own lives ended. So they go even further.
And that's a hard enough ethical choice. But the even harder one, it seems to me, is when the person does not want to commit physician-assisted suicide, but then somebody else tells them, no, this care is not available to you.
Well, we all have had experiences where care has not been available to us, and not necessarily at end-of-life issues. But I do want to say something else about hospice, because David mentioned that, you know, there isn't enough reimbursement right now. Actually, reimbursement right now, I think, is 80% by Medicare for hospice stays for 6 months or less. So that's fairly good. However, right under the Bush administration, the last Bush administration, they tried to reduce that by 3%, and hospices are now fighting that correctly. So I just want people to be aware that things could get worse if hospices found their costs reduced dramatically.
Here's a rabbi from Connecticut calling in. Malik. Did I say your name right? Is it Malik?
Actually, it's just Mark.
Oh, Mark. And, I'm sorry. Hi.
I sit on the ethics committee of my local hospital. And over, I've seen colleagues from what I'll call very conservative religious traditions, Orthodox traditions, really push this as hard as possible and minister to their, the people they're caring for, that life is around as long as that heart is beating, and giving that kind of advice all the way to people in end-stage cancer. You know, as long as your heart is beating, we have to do everything we can to fight to keep you alive. And part of this dialogue means engaging people from those religious traditions or placing severe limits on them, one or the other. But it ain't going to be pretty, I could tell you that.
So the fact that we're such a religious country might be an impediment to enacting some policies along these lines, Mark, you think?
You can be a liberal religious person or a conservative religious, not just
right.
about religious.
I understand.
It's a specific brand of religion.
Right. Okay, fair enough. And Judy, you're nodding your head.
Well, here's what I think. I think any family who's had somebody they love die a very protracted and painful death, religious or not, even religious people, will quarrel with their rabbi or their priest on this issue. And I speak from the heart because my dad died that way. And I do know that when I called my own personal doctor and I said, what do I do? They're forcing my dad to live with feeding tubes, and he never wanted that. They didn't obey his living will. And my doctor said, tell them you won't pay the bill. I'll never forget that piece of advice.
And here's a cruel irony post, which kind of, I think, deepens your point. This is, for those of you on our website, this is post 23 on the comments page for this segment. Tom from the Upper West Side says, my father is 88 and has insurance and Medicare. Though neither will pay for certain things that would enhance his life, a new hearing aid, for instance, either would cover any and all heroic hospitalization costs at the end of life. My sister, with whom he lives, is a cancer survivor who can't get her own insurance now and is too young for Medicare. So, wow, David, there it all is in a nutshell. She can't get insurance, so the costs aren't going to her, who would probably benefit, and the quality of life expenditures for his father are not being funded, I guess so they can save up for his last 2 weeks of life.
Exactly, and that's why this whole debate about rationing, you know, how could we ever ration health care, is so misguided. We do ration health care. We are rationing health care. The lack of a hearing aid in this example is rationing.
And insane.
And insane. And so, you know, in some sort of utopia, maybe we wouldn't have to ration because we would have limitless resources. But that's not the world we live in, and we have to ration. We do ration already. And so the question is, do we want to spend money on stuff that doesn't make us healthier and in some ways maybe even not what we want, or do we want to spend it on stuff that improves the quality of our lives?
All right. Well, David Leonhardt from the New York Times interviewed President Obama, and we're surprised that the president brought up this end-of-life cost reimbursement issue, and you can see that. Oh, it's a pretty long excerpt, which you can see at their website on the New York Times. And Judy Bachrach, founder of the online advice column, thecheckoutline.org, a contributing editor at Vanity Fair, and frequent contributor and columnist to Obit magazine, which is a magazine about life, death, and transitions. We have links to the checkout line and some of Judy's work at our site, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Thank you for having this difficult
My
conversation.
My pleasure. Brian,
thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay tuned.